work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Many would-be lawyers are reluctant to get into contentious specialties like corporate litigators. Well, assisted reproduction law, it's a fancy term, but we'll explain it in a minute, is a new specialty that avoids a lot of that. You know, it's about helping people have babies. It feels rather different than, different from, two sharks fighting over which big organization, for-profit or non-profit, should get more zillions. Besides, to me, at least, it feels intrinsically interesting, that intersection of technological progress with the emotional issues of parents and surrogates. So I thought you might enjoy a segment on what it's really like to be an assisted reproduction attorney. And because I know absolutely nothing about it, it is my pleasure to introduce Attorney Richard Vaughn, a gay married father of twins that he got through assisted reproduction, and he is the founder of the International Fertility Law Group, which focuses exclusively on assisted reproductive law. He also heads the American Bar Association's assisted reproduction section and is co-author of the book Developing a Successful Assisted Reproduction Technology Law Practice. Richard Vaughn, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be here.
So, you got interested in the field through your own experience with assisted reproduction. Tell me about it.
Yes, so my husband and I decided early in our relationship that we wanted children, and we looked into our options, which were adoption and assisted reproduction. Mm-hmm. And along the way, did our research, met with a bunch of people, and found out, you know, tried to educate ourselves. And as the process of assisted reproduction begins for most of my clients now, we met with an attorney who explained to us, you know, all that would be involved in that process. And I was fascinated with that process. And so shortly after that call, I called him back and said, what's it like to be in this field? And it happened to be right time and right place. And I've been practicing exclusively in this area ever since.
And you said it was fascinating. What was fascinating to you about it?
You know, in assisted reproduction, especially third-party assisted reproduction, where intended parents are going to be working with an egg donor or a surrogate or sperm donor, you have to start off with contracts between the parties. And the issues that these contracts touch on are quite interesting and unlike any other contract that I'd ever seen in my practice as a lawyer up to that point. And, of course, you know, I was personally interested as an intended parent what this process was like, so it was kind of like a match made in heaven, and I was thinking, you know, what better way to finish out my career than to help people make babies.
And this lawyer who you then spoke to and told you what it was really like, was there anything surprising he told you, or something that was dispositive, forgive the legal term, that motivated you to actually say, you know, I want to go into this career?
Well, it really was just the idea that I could help others going through this process, especially in the LGBT community, which I'm a part of, mm-hmm. To be able to share what I've learned and help other people through it. Just that was the most fascinating part about it.
And from that human perspective, in terms of you and your husband making the decision, was it a challenge to decide whether you wanted to go the adoption route or the assisted reproductive route, and where was the tension in there?
I don't know that it was a major challenge. We did thoroughly investigate both options and went to some meetings with other adoptive parents and heard their stories of, you know, how they went through their adoptions. And what we heard more frequently than we were comfortable with was the idea that there were some who had gone through the adoption process only to have the birth mother change her mind. Mm-hmm. Or if they were in the foster program, you know, they would have the child for a few months and then the child would be placed back with the family. So that didn't sound like something that we wanted to take a risk on.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's turn, you use the term intended parents. Now, just for people who, you know, I hadn't heard of this until you and I did our pre-interview, but the intended parents are the ones who want to bring up the kid or kids, and there could be a birth mother or a sperm donor or an egg donor. Those are not the intended parent. We're talking about, when we use the term intended parents, it's those people who want to bring the kids up, right?
Yes, those who intend to conceive a child with the help of assisted reproduction.
Okay, and so without getting into the legal weeds, no, before I actually do that, you know, there was something, as I was listening to you, there was something kind of almost factual about it. Was there a significant amount of emotion that you and your husband, either you and or your husband, went through in at any stage of this, what you call the intended parent's journey?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the questions we asked a lot in the very beginning was, why do women volunteer to do this, especially to act as a surrogate? Mm. That was a very interesting human point for us as to why the women did it, because, of course, you know, from our perspective as an intended parent going through the process, we want to know that she's in it for the right reasons and that we're not taking any unnecessary risks in this process.
Won't it vary? Won't it sometimes be for the money? What are some of the other reasons that someone might want to be a surrogate mom?
Well, by and large, most of the surrogates, certainly that I've worked with, I work with both intended parents and surrogates. They are in this because they do want to help. They typically know someone in their family or circle of friends who is either struggling or has struggled with fertility issues or had secondary fertility through cancer, for instance, or their same-sex parents, and this is one of their only options, or they're single. So they do want to help. And then, of course, there's the monetary component, but that cannot be the primary motivation for them. And they do get psychologically screened and evaluated to make sure that they're doing this for the right reasons and that they would be fully committed to what they're getting into.
So
I found that part of it fascinating.
Yeah. Well, let's say somebody wanted to do it primarily for the money, but was psychologically screened, is not going to, become dissolute because of all this, and psychologically dissolute. Why is it not acceptable? You know, it's pretty saintly to want to take on pregnancy, which is no joke, and there is risk, to one's health. It's almost a step or two removed from being a kidney donor. Why is it not acceptable ethically for somebody to say, I know what I'm getting into. I've been fully disclosed, and I'm doing because I want to make the $25,000 or $50,000 or whatever they charge. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's not to say that that could never happen, but I think what you would find is, what we typically discuss with the surrogates when we talk about this issue is, when the going gets tough, the tough can't get going. They can't just leave.
Mm-hmm.
This is once they're pregnant and they're involved in this process and they're frustrated because they're not, quote unquote, earning enough, or the money's not enough, because it really isn't. It's never enough.
How much is it normally? Is it normally? Okay.
The pregnancy fees, for instance, the rates are somewhere in the range of $30,000 to $40,000. It varies across the country a little bit and whether the surrogate is experienced, et cetera. But when you boil that down to kind of like, let's say, an hourly rate over a function that lasts 9.5 months, 24 hours a day, it comes down to something like $2 or $3 an hour. So they cannot be doing it for the money.
Sounds like being a writer. I actually have best-selling books, and when I calculate the per-hour earnings, I could have made more money flipping burgers, I swear.
Indeed.
But anyway, let's go back through the process. Now, without getting into the weeds, walk me through that, what you term the intended parent's journey, including where emotions can get involved.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, many intended parents come to this process with fertility issues that they've been dealing with for many years, failed attempts at having a child. They have secondary infertility because of cancer treatments, etc. Mm-hmm. So they've been through a long process already of failure or loss when they come to this conclusion through the doctor's assistance that, this is the only option for them. So there's been a lot of turmoil in their history in getting to this point. And the same could be true for single intended parents and same-sex intended parents, maybe less so on an emotional scale. But this is one of their only options, and it's an expensive option. So none of these parents come to this process flippantly. They look at this very carefully. They have to plan and save. And when they finally get to the point where they're ready to begin, they have to meet with a cadre of professionals. They meet with lawyers. They meet with psychologists. They meet with doctors. They meet with agencies who help match them. So there's a lot of players involved, and it's a lot of information to absorb at the beginning, and it can be very overwhelming.
And so when I listen to that, this ethical question comes into my mind. There's lots of unadopted babies, adoptable babies, not just in the United States but worldwide, and we talk about the overwhelmed healthcare system, and here we have these people who are spending a fortune and using up a huge amount of medical resources to create their own baby because they want it to be somehow, even if it's not their sperm or egg, it's somehow theirs. Is there an ethical question that perhaps even you and your husband discussed podcast about the ethics of going through all of that and using all those resources to create your own baby, even if not your biological baby, when there are zillions of would-be adoptable kids who will therefore then not get adopted.
If we were in a courtroom, I'd object to the complex question. Too many, like five questions in one.
I'm sorry.
But it's an interesting question and one that we've dealt with before, certainly as parents and as attorneys. What I mentioned earlier is that when you do look into adoption, there are risks that you have to be aware of and you have to be prepared to take those. You know, having a child is a very personal decision, and whether you have a child through adoption and help a needy child or have a child through assisted reproduction, you're still creating your family. And in this country, we do not tell people how to create their families. So I don't see an ethical issue there.
Okay, cool. That's what I wanted to know. I wanted to get you on the record for that. You are listening to Work with Marty Namco. I'm talking with Richard Vaughn. He is the president of the American Bar Association's Assisted Reproduction Section. We're talking about, one of the less contentious kinds of law. I have so many clients over the years who are lawyers and are unhappy because of the incredible pressures to bill, the pressures from clients, the ever growing amount of amazing amount of data that needs to be reviewed, discovery in order to prepare for cases, even the transactional attorneys who are reading through incredibly complex sheaves of data. And here is this, and I like to stay current on the show and present new things. There is this quite new, it only really has accelerated in the past few years with the technological advancement, called assisted reproduction law. And that's why, dear listeners, I am sharing this with you, and because I know nothing about the subject, it is my pleasure to be talking with Richard Vaughn, who is the president of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproduction Section, and his practice in California is exclusive. It's called the International Fertility Law Group, and that's what he focuses on. Okay, is there most of what you do is you work out these contracts and you make sure there's full disclosure. In preparing for the show, I was shocked. That's a little too strong. I was amazed at the amount of detail that these contracts go into. So I read a contract provision in one of these contracts that says the contract regulates the amount of, and I'm quoting here, rough, scandalous sex, end quote, and nipple stimulation that a surrogate mother can engage in because strenuous activity can endanger pregnancy. What's another surprising clause that you have negotiated in an assisted reproduction attorney situation?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that after having done, close to 12,000 cases, I've never seen that provision in a contract. So that is quite rare, but conduct during pregnancy is typically addressed in these surrogacy agreements, and usually the basics are follow doctor's instructions and everybody agrees to basic universal things like no smoking, no drinking, no drugs, no dangerous activities. And it can get as detailed as the parties want it to get. But, some of the more interesting ones that I've seen, there was one just within the last year where an intended mother who is in the business of selling and promoting vitamins, vitamin supplements, and essential oils wanted her surrogate to take these pills and supplements and oils on a particular schedule. There was a whole schedule laid out of what time of day and when. So that was pretty fascinating, but they agreed to do it.
I want to reiterate on the record, this is actually an active member, I'm not going to resist it, but an active member of your section of the American Bar Association, and it was a published article in which she wrote that quote about the provision. So it may not have occurred in your practice, but I promise you it occurred in somebody else.
I don't doubt it. The new things that we face in these contracts never cease to amaze me. After doing it now for 12 years consistently, there's always something new.
Right. Now, when you, at the very beginning of the segment, you were talking about the fact that the surrogate and the sperm or egg donor really just, is there, doesn't really have rights, or implied that, has no rights as the parent or obligations as the parent, but there are exceptions. Where might a sperm donor or an egg donor or a surrogate mom have some parental rights, or where might the state impose that kind of right on the donor?
Well, normally we don't see exceptions to this, idea that there are no parental rights for the donors or surrogates in egg donor cases and in surrogacy cases, but we can see them sometimes in what we call known sperm donor cases from time to time. And this is where the parties all know each other and agree that this gentleman is going to donate sperm to this individual or couple for the purposes of procreation. And sometimes because they're friends, they're going to stay involved in each other's lives. And so you can write up the contract that makes it very clear that the donor is just a donor, and that's all, with no parental rights or obligations. But they can mess that whole thing up by behaving differently. So their contract is now worthless if they now behave in a different way, where he is, in some sense, holding out as a parent, providing support, whether emotional or financial, such that he, to the level of, you know, what a parent would. And so if that happens, he can either, you know, make a claim for some shared parental rights or custody, or the intended parents or the recipients of the sperm can make a claim that he owes some responsibility toward child support. So could the state.
I would guess that this could occur when, let's say, the sperm donor wanted to, found himself later wanting to be involved in the parenting, and then the intended parents said no. He then said, you know what I can do? I'm going to claim that they are providing an inadequate quality of care, and I need to do that as an ethical responsibility. Is that kind of argument work, or am I making that up? Is that a Hollywood movie?
Well, it's both. yeah, that could happen, theoretically. I mean, look, that could happen in any other parenting situation, regardless of whether assisted reproduction was used. If parents are not properly caring for that child and putting that child in danger, then there are mechanisms through family law to perhaps, you know, address those issues and you know, reduce custody or have shared custody. We now have in some states the ability to have a third or fourth legal parent in situations just like this.
And a related point is, you talked about the standard in these contracts is that the surrogate mother says, I agree not to do drugs or smoke or whatever. And let's say, we won't make promises that we don't necessarily, much as we are well-intentioned, somehow we succumb. And so let's say the surrogate parent breaches the contract and does drugs or smokes, and therefore potentially at least harms the fetus. What does the law say in those situations?
Well, just for the listeners' clarity, we're jumping from sperm donor now to surrogate cases. So,
yes.
In the situation where a surrogate is breaching the contract by not following doctor's instructions and doing these things that she agreed not to do, there's usually a process to follow first. If there's a breach or you think there's a breach, give her notice that there's a problem and she needs to fix it. Give her time to fix it. The contracts usually address a short period of time for these things to be remedied. If they can't be remedied or undone, then the parties can pursue their rights through more formal means, whether it's mediation or arbitration or litigation. That gets tricky, though, especially if she's pregnant, because, you know, right. I don't know if you want to be dragging your pregnant surrogate into court over an issue. So generally, these things do get worked out at the informal level. This is generally a very collaborative industry. So the parties get together, they talk among the attorneys or with the agency. Sometimes the surrogate will have some additional counseling to remind her of why she's doing this and why it's important that she follow instructions. So 99.99 times out of 100, these things get resolved.
Again, maybe I'm delusional, but I think that all makes an assumption that it would be known. If I'm a surrogate mom, and let's say I sign with full intention to not drink or do pot or whatever, but then a month or two later, I'm getting nausea. And I'm saying, you know, I know that marijuana can reduce nausea. I'm certainly not going to disclose this in the privacy of my closed door. I may, let's say, vape my butt off for both because of the anxiety and because of the nausea, and I might not even know about it. Do the contracts at all call for random drug testing or no?
They do. They do actually call for random drug testing. So that's a very standard provision.
I see. Okay. Just was checking. In the past few years, there's been a move from what's called genetic surrogacy, surrogate mom, to gestational surrogacy. Explain the difference and why has the move occurred?
Well, so first of all, genetic is sort of the new term to be used for what used to be called traditional surrogacy. And this is a type of surrogacy where the surrogate is not only the carrier of the pregnancy, but also the genetic provider. So her eggs are used, and her eggs could be fertilized in vitro or IVF at the clinic,
right.
Or the parties can attempt artificial insemination or do an IUI, intrauterine insemination. So that's what traditional surrogacy is. In this case, the surrogate is also the genetic contributor.
And is IUI, I mean, simply the, you know, the woman who say, hey, I know this guy, he's a great guy, I'm going to, or the, let's say, you know, you could do it the traditional way. They could have intercourse, right? Is that IUI? Is that what that refers to?
That would not be assisted reproduction.
Okay.
That would be intercourse, and then they would both be treated as parents. So.
But what would happen, let's say there's a married couple, straight or gay, doesn't matter, but let's say the married couple decides that they don't want to carry, a woman, in, let's say it's a heterosexual couple, so there's a woman, doesn't want to carry a baby, and so they agree that there was this third party, let's say a friend, who they think would be a good mom, and the mom agrees to be a surrogate parent, and they therefore have intercourse. Are there special rules and laws that govern that?
Well, that would be, again, classically defined as not assisted reproduction.
Okay.
They've just gone outside the parameters of any assisted reproduction.
I see. And so this was a little sidetrack on the conversation about genetic, what used to be traditional surrogacy,
right.
And now gestational. What's gestational and why has the move been toward that?
So in the 1980s, when surrogacy began, most of the cases were traditional surrogacy cases, and there was a famous Baby M case out of New Jersey where a traditional surrogate changed her mind and wanted to keep the child. They all went to court. The court said she's still the mother.
Mm-hmm.
They then continued their legal battle for several more years. The intended parents did end up with custody of the child, but the surrogate was still listed as the mother. So to avoid that risk, many states over time shifted toward, and clinics and agencies all shifted toward gestational surrogacy, where the surrogate is not the genetic contributor to the child. So she's not carrying, you know, quote unquote, her
right.
child. She's carrying the child for the intended parents, and she's not genetically connected.
And so
that's considered safer.
Yes, exactly. And I could see where that would be. Let's turn back more explicitly to your own practice. What might surprise me, either good, bad, or simply interesting, about your work as an assisted reproduction attorney?
Well, one of the things that we deal with specifically at my firm, and a lot of assisted reproduction attorneys do as well, but you know what we are able to do here, because the laws allow it, is not allowed in many countries of the world.
Mm.
So we have intended parents from many countries of the world coming here to create their family, and one of the things that we have to make sure they can do is get back home safely and consider what citizenship the child will ultimately have.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of a specific case where there was either an interesting challenge or a cultural difference that you needed to accommodate to? Anything of that nature?
Sure. I had an intended parent couple, heterosexual couple from Italy, of course, where surrogacy is highly illegal.
Mm.
From a human interest perspective, you know, she was so afraid of being found out, intended mother, that she wore a fake baby bump that would get bigger in size throughout the pregnancy.
Wow.
Just to create the appearance that she was pregnant so that no one in her home country would suspect.
Wow.
Of course, then she came here, the baby was born, and then she went back and, you know.
Amazing. Good story.
Yeah.
What else might surprise me in you? You know, you said 12,000 cases. What else might surprise me from a human or just a practical business standpoint about your practice as an assisted reproduction attorney?
I don't know. We've touched on a lot of interesting issues already.
Cool. All right. I don't want to push it unless something comes to mind. I've got a couple of other questions that I think are fascinating. The ethics I love. You know, you can see already I'm really into this. This is, again, could be an anomaly, but I think my listeners would find it interesting. Let's say, for example, a surrogate mom gets into a serious car accident, and she's dying. And she has an advanced medical directive that says she doesn't want extraordinary measures taken to prolong her life. But the intended parents, the ones who would be the parents raising the kid, want the mom on life support. They spent all this money, they're emotionally invested in it or whatever, so they can have the baby, even if that means that birth mother has prolonged dying and suffering in great pain and perhaps incurs great cost. What happens in a case like that?
Well, it's definitely a very sensitive issue for all the parties involved, and hopefully the contract addresses this. We certainly address it in all of our contracts. We have the parties sit down and talk about this very scenario so that if it does occur, there's not a lot of extra drama. It's already hard enough for all of those involved.
Sure.
And at that point, during the prior to the point the contract is signed, you're discussing this. You're also looking at any advanced directives that the surrogate already has in place, and to the extent they might be inconsistent, we need to get everybody on the same page, including her advanced directives, so that those with authority to make decisions for her in that scenario are aware of what she's agreed to in the contract.
You know, that's why people are frustrated with lawyers, because they have to sweat all these details. But in the end, that's part of why they're paying you. There's so many zebras, so many anomalies that could occur, and they could be so painful in their implications that a lawyer doing his or her job has really got to sweat those details. Is that a fair assertion?
Absolutely. We deal with issues such as life support. We deal with death of intended parents in the contract. We deal with the issues, the tough issues of abortion and selective reduction if those occur. So we do have to address a lot of very difficult issues up front so that the parties are prepared.
You mentioned the issue of selective reduction. Again, that's a term you know, and you taught it to me in our pre-interview, but it means if that woman gets pregnant with triplets, twins or triplets or more, that in the contract, the intended parents only want one kid. They don't want a house full, a basketball team full. There is the right to reduction. But then there was the Melissa Cook case. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, yeah, you definitely want to address in the contracts the number of fetuses, the maximum, pregnancy that the surrogate is willing to carry, and you have to honor that. Mm-hmm. And if she gets pregnant with more than that number of fetuses, then you need to discuss fetal reduction with the clinic and all parties. And it could also happen in the case of a serious abnormality or defect with the baby or the pregnancy.
Yes.
These do typically get addressed, and you want to make sure everyone's on the same page. But the Melissa Cook case, that's an interesting case, somewhat recent, in California, where a divorced single repeat surrogate matched with a single intended father, and they went through the screening process, they went through the contract process, and the contract stated that they would reduce in the event that she got pregnant with three or more. She got pregnant with three and then had agreed to reduce but then refused. Interestingly, she offered to keep one of the babies so that the father didn't have to parent three. Of course, he rejected that and agreed with his contractual statement that he would be the parent of any resulting children. And then they went to the process of what we all do in these cases, these surrogacy cases. We have to go to court to get a court order to confirm that the intended parent or parents are the legal parents and that the surrogate is not. These are typically not contentious filings. They're agreed filings, but she didn't agree. So she said, you know what, I don't agree. I want to be the parent of all three. And the court, considered all the facts and, of course, the law and sided with what the law says, which is that, if they agreed in a contract prior to an embryo transfer that he would be the legal parent and that she would not, that had to be honored. So her claim was rejected by the court. She then filed a number of appeals at various state courts and federal courts and has lost all of them.
Wow. I got one more of these ethical questions that I'm curious about. Now, grandparents typically will leave money for a future grandchild. And at some point, the grandparents die, say. And then the parents happen to have a baby using in vitro fertilization, IVF, that is somebody else's sperm, let's say, and egg. So that child has none of the grandparents' genes. Is that child, now the grandparents had fully intended, I want to pass my genes along and I want to support that. So now you've got this grandchild where it's neither of the grandparents' genes. Is that child legally entitled to the grandparents' money?
So I'm going to give you an answer. Assisted reproduction attorneys are certainly not typical in their field, and I'm going to give you a typical lawyer answer.
Okay.
The answer is it depends.
Right.
I mean, in your scenario, the parents are using IVF, meaning they're fertilizing their embryos in the clinic. You didn't say surrogacy, so I'm assuming in this they're just creating embryos at the clinic and getting pregnant on their own.
No, I want to make sure that in this case, because it's an interesting, more ethical question, it's neither parent's egg. Let's say the father, the intended parents, his sperm is no good, her eggs are no good, so they use surrogacy for an egg donor and a sperm donor. so that the baby that is resultant has none of the genes from the parents, and the grandparents said, you know, right, that's what I'm talking about.
No, I understand the scenario.
Oh, okay, cool.
You can get pregnant and carry with an embryo that was not...
Okay, cool.
You were genetically, that's what surrogates do all the time.
Okay.
But in this scenario, let's just assume a surrogate. I don't think it really changes the answer.
Okay.
I mean, the law presumes that any pregnant woman is the mother and her husband is the father. So these parents would be the natural parents through birth if they carried. If they used a surrogate, they would be declared the legal parents.
Mm-hmm.
But it also depends on how the grandparents' estate planning documents are worded. We have a lot of labels that we use in family law that, you know, until the last 30 years have been taken for granted and weren't questioned. Things like natural parent or biological parent. We have to focus on legal parent. But if those documents that they signed as the grandparents use the word natural child or biological child or offspring or heir, we may have something vague that could be, needs to be interpreted by the parties or their attorneys or, if it gets ugly, the court.
Right.
I would imagine it would likely be resolved in favor of the children that would be inheriting.
Right.
But if those documents refer to, I hereby give my estate to any of my genetic children, descendants, heirs, and they use the word genetic, then those kids are likely to not inherit.
It's
obviously quite the interesting intersection of ART or assisted reproduction law and trust and estate. So, we always say that those involved in any kind of assisted reproduction should definitely take a close look at their family's estate planning documents, not only their own, but their families, so that those that are not intended to be cut out won't be.
Let's end with one kind of a softball general question. You know, every single guest who's probably ever been on this show has, when they email me afterwards to thank me or whatever, they say, oh, I wish you would have asked me about that, or I wish I would have said that. I want to give you that. Is there anything you want to tell our listeners that you haven't yet said about what it's really like to be an assisted reproduction attorney?
Well, I would say that if anyone out there is considering assisted reproduction, it's a complicated area.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to do it at home. Definitely seek professional advice. There's so many areas where you can get tripped up and get into trouble and have mistakes and have them come back to haunt you for years to come. So it's really important to get the advice of attorneys and psychologists and talk to the doctors and not do this at home.
Well, I can say without any doubt, I mean, clearly, Richard Vaughn, I did my homework, as I try to always do. This guy heads the American Bar Association's Assisted Reproduction Section. He's co-authored a book on the subject. He's had 12,000 clients, and he himself used assisted reproduction to get his kids, as it happens to be twins. So I do commend Richard Vaughn. I'm sure you can just Google International Fertility Law Group, and you will find Richard Vaughn. And so, Richard, it has been a pleasure having you a guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a pleasure as well.
Be well. Bye-bye. And now we turn to you, my dear listeners. One of the foundational part of this show is not so much talking about these third-party things, policy or an individual, some career, but helping you. That's what this show is at its core about. And so if you or someone you care about has a work-related problem, either because you're unemployed or in many cases you could be, quote, well-employed and still unhappy with your job, with a coworker, with an ethical situation, or you're self-employed or thinking about it and want to run your idea by me, those are all good reasons to call for what I call a workover. And the phone number for this is a great time when the lines are available. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, the price is certainly right, 0 zip or nada. This is my pro bono work, and KALW brings it to you. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to talk about a technique while I'm waiting for the calls to come in. I want to talk about a technique that has been inordinately helpful to my clients, and yet is remarkably simple. It's simple enough that I can share with you on the air. So many people end up having irrational, emotional feelings and reactions that frustrate them and keep them stuck. At least with my career counseling clients, when they're thinking, for example, oh my God, nobody's going to hire me, or I am so angry at my boss or my coworker or whatever, or I'm an imposter, I really don't know anything, is a tool I call thought stopping. As soon as you become aware of an unproductive thought, literally say stop and ask yourself, what constructive task could I turn my attention to? What's my first 1 second baby step on that task? For example, if the unproductive thought is, no one's going to hire me, an appropriate distractor might be, okay, should I get a new skill? Should I fix my resume? Should I network more? Should I change my job target? Then after you pick one of those goals, then take that next baby step. If it's, for example, to get a new skill, it might be reading an article that's near the top of a Google search result. It might be watching a YouTube video. It might be signing up for some online course through Udemy or LinkedIn Learning or an in-person course at a local college or extension. If it's to fix your resume, a baby step might be to show it to a trusted colleague and ask for feedback or play around with Zetty. It's my first choice best resume builder, Z-E-T-Y. If you want to network more, should it be with your existing friends and colleagues? Maybe by inviting them to your place or out for dinner or drinks or go for a hike. Or if it's to extend your network, maybe by attending a professional conference or a meetup. Or if you think you might need to change your job target, maybe your current field's overcrowded or the level of job you're targeting is too high, at least for now. What if your unproductive, I like to give specific examples. So what if your unproductive thought is, I'm so angry at my boss, my co-worker, my spouse, my parent, whatever. The distracting positive baby step could be to ask yourself, should you try to fix the relationship? Because even though we're talking about work, so often relationships can spill over. Anxiety about relationships can spill over. Should you journal about it? Should you just move on? So the point is that every time you get an unproductive thought, really it's wise to say stop and distract yourself, because otherwise you tend to spiral down into more miring because more of your mind is dominated by that negative thought. One more, I have to give you one more example. So many people, especially if they're freshly out of university, where the emphasis tends to be on theory, they feel, I'm an imposter. You do need to recognize that so much of what is taught in university-based training programs is theoretical, and that even the practical, because so much content is dropped on you en masse, by the time you need to use it, you may well have forgotten it or it's become obsolete. So, to some extent, you are an imposter. But you don't need to blame yourself fully for this. Some of it may rest at your training program's feet. So, but as I said, we live in an era in which practical learning of quality is easier to obtain than ever. So whether it's hanging out in your field's online forum on LinkedIn, or picking out a top-rated online course or an in-person course, or hiring a tutor live or by phone or by Skype, or simply, as I said, Googling and checking out articles on a just-in-time basis, it's easier than ever to get competent. So thought-stopping, instead of miring yourself down when you have that unproductive thought, really force yourself. It really works, at least for many of my clients. Think about what would be a constructive task to turn to and what would be your next 1 second task to get started on that. Anyway, we got calls on the line, so let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hello.
I was just wondering what advice you have for someone who has a seemingly impossible a dream or something that they really want to do, and they're stuck in jobs that they have a lot of discourse with. They hate their job, or they just can't stand a job that's not for them. Maybe they're more aware than the job really is.
Okay. There are so many different approaches to that, so you need to be specific. What's your dream?
I want to be in theater or an actor.
Okay, you want to be an actor. So there are a number of choices, and the right one depends on who you are. Which of the following feels right as a next step? Do you want to take an acting course? Do you want to audition for a play? Do you want to, if you already feel you're a good actor, do you want to create a video and send it out to directors? Do you want to focus on a certain kind of acting, whether it be for non-profit promotional videos or for movies or for video games or for commercials? Where are you in the process? Which of those feels right?
Well, right now in the process, I'm just stuck in working at jobs, and it seems like I'm on a treadmill. I can never get to the next step of auditioning or...
Why not? There are too many, many, it is a cliche, how many actors have day jobs where they are a waiter or whatever they're doing. It could be a soulless job. I'm familiar with Wallace Stevens, the famous novelist who ended up teaching at Stanford, but he worked as an insurance salesman for a long time until he became a writer. Most people can't afford, don't have the luxury, oh, I think I'll quit and I'll just work on being an actor because you'll starve because the cost of living in the Bay Area is crazy. So most people accept that if you have the long shot dream, there are some people, if you're fortunate enough to be able to quit and just devote yourself 12 hours a day to your craft of being an actor, you can do that. But most people can't. Can you afford to quit and devote yourself for years on the, frankly, long shot odds of getting making even a marginally decent living as an actor? Or do you need to keep working?
Keep working.
And do you need to keep working at this job, or is it so soul-sucking or otherwise bad that you need to find another interim job? That's why so many people do jobs as like a waiter, because you can do the job as a waiter, the tips tend to be quite good, and then when you're done, you're done. You don't have to take the work home with you, and that still leaves enough time for many people, not everybody, to work on their acting craft. Should you change jobs to something that leaves you more emotional and temporal bandwidth to work on your acting?
Yes, probably, yes.
Okay, so let's talk about the interim job. So do you want to tell me what you currently do?
I was a deli clerk at a grocery store. Just quit my job yesterday.
Okay, and so should you get out of food service, or because it's always easier to get a job in the same general field, should you work for a better employer, but in the food service field, or do you really feel you'd be wise to get out of food service, even if it's an interim job?
Better employer.
Better employer, great. And so in the food service world, there are so many different attributes that can make you employable. Are you great with customers? Are you very fast at chopping lettuce? Are you an artisan at decorating cake? Where are your greatest strengths in the food service world?
I think working as part of the production team or the kitchen team.
Awesome. Okay, and are you more of a fine dining guy, or are you more of a sandwich maker kind of guy?
Fine dining all the way. I want to work for Thomas Keller.
Love it. Well, that, again, it's really dangerous if you're working as a deli clerk now. Thomas Keller, unless you're his best friends with him, ain't going to hire you. But there's no reason you can't get into fine dining. There's a zillion fine dining places. So I would invite you to create a resume that highlights your fine dining production skills, and then either apply for jobs online, but even I'm a big fan, even though in this modern era, I am not tech-phobic at all, but especially in the restaurant biz. What city do you live in?
Berkeley.
Well, you've got, of course, there's a zillion of these fine dining places in the gourmet ghetto, of course, from Chez Panisse on down, but there's a zillion of them. I would make a point on like weekday mornings at like 10 or 11 in the morning before things get crazy. I would dress well, walk in, I'd say in a suit. A production guy's not going to be in a suit. But just dress with a collared shirt or whatever, and a resume that highlights your fine dining skills. Walk in with a good attitude and say, you have these skills and you're looking for a job, even on a fill-in basis, for now, working in the production team in fine dining. And I can't guarantee you, but if you're really as good as you imply in that fine dining area, you will, if you go to 10 or 20 of them, one's going to hire you at least as a substitute, because we know that the no-show rate in restaurants is huge in terms of the workers. And so somebody who's available on call at minimum is like manna from heaven for lots of restaurants. And even if you are just a sous chef who is just chopping lettuce, as a starter to get in, that might be a way to get out of your crappy job that you don't like now. And then, because especially you're probably going to only be hired on a part-time or an on-call basis, then you need to laser focus on becoming an awesome actor. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Really good.
Cool. Well, I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. I do have other calls on the line, but I want to give out the phone number. If you want some career help, I love it. I mean, this guy is kind of an entry-level guy, and yet I feel like I can help him. I can help you. I've been doing this almost 29 years now. I love the problem, the tougher the better, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, for-profit, non-profit, or government, 16 or 76. The tougher the problem, the better. For my listeners, for me, and of course for you, because it means your problem is more desperate. The phone number here for what I call a workover, 415. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello? Are you there?
Can you hear me?
I hear you beautifully.
Okay, great. I'm calling about a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine.
Okay.
Who was a dean in a liberal arts college for a lot of years.
Yep.
And that, that job, her, they were restructuring, and her boss got fired, and so she decided to get another job.
Okay.
You know, that she did it because she thought she'd be leaving. And she went to an Ivy League school, and that just wasn't for her.
Okay.
So she's 1 year, she only worked there for 1 year, and now she's looking for other jobs.
Okay.
She's a woman. She's 63.
Mm-hmm.
We were wondering, you know, is when somebody's a little bit older like that, is it something that one should address when in an interview, like talk about it?
Excellent question. Two things. First of all, whatever your age, to get to be a dean or a similar kind of job, it's unfortunate. We tend to think of universities as places that are high-minded institutions of learning, but in the end, especially at the dean level, you know what it comes down to? Money. Bringing in grants. If you could say, you know, if she goes and interviews and she talks about these ideas for grants and that these are likely sources of grants, or that she, even better, I am assuming she doesn't have, you know, grant money now, but if she could talk about how she's likely to be to bring in money, even to create a program that she's quite confident would bring in students, that would be very helpful. And in terms of her age, they can't ask about it legally, but I advise my clients to bring it up. To say, you may wonder, as somebody in their 60s, am I having, you know, 1 foot toward retirement or whatever? I want to let you know that I still have plenty of fire in my belly. I'm very excited. I feel I am fortunate, if it's true, of course, you know, to be in great physical health and mental health. And I know you can't ask about that, but I wanted to bring it up because I'm confident it is a non-issue. I like my clients to bring it up like that. And I, you know, depending on her situation, if she comes in and she, you know, she has the gray pallor of somebody who has stage 4 cancer, that's another story. But for under most situations, if she's reasonably healthy and reasonable energy, I would encourage her to bring it up.
Okay. There's another part to it.
Okay.
She had worked and had a big staff in student services.
Yep.
She was supervising.
Okay.
Like, people or something.
Yep.
And she would like to work directly with students and have a smaller staff.
What she should do there is it's appropriate to add, it's fine to add, to make that, if she restricts herself to that, there may be too few jobs available. So I would encourage you to make that what's called a desiderata, something she would like but isn't a non-negotiable. She needs to have a reasonable, moderate amount of flexibility. If she's in student services, she can certainly say that she's fully capable of doing some direct work with students as well as administrative supervision work, but she's not saying it's a non-negotiable. And sometimes, even if they like you enough, even if the original job description has very little student contact, when they hire you in the negotiation of your job, in your negotiation, part of what you can negotiate is your job description. You say, you know, I really would like to have a little direct service. I'm particularly good at working with, blah, students with this kind of problem or that kind of problem. And very often they'll make at least a minor accommodation. But I wouldn't make that a bottom line requirement. I would make that I would sell that as a strength that you could do both supervision as well as students. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah, and more talk about that after they've hired you as the details of your contract or when you're in the interview.
I don't mind her bringing it up as a strength that she could do both and saying that she would prefer to have some direct student work and some administrative, but not make it a requirement. And then, you know, and get their reactions. And then if she's offered the job, she can say, you know, I did mention in the interview that I would prefer a measure of supervision and a well-directed service to students. Might that be possible to rejigger at least a little of my job description so I can do a little direct service?
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. We've got a lot of lines lighted up, so let's just go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me, sir?
I do.
I have a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of going for my MFA in screenwriting at UCLA or CSU Northridge.
The reason I'm laughing is because the head of the school grading department, Lou Hunter, was on this show a few years ago. Go ahead.
Okay. And the reason I mentioned MFA instead of MA is I was told by an instructor that go for an MFA because with an MFA one can teach. And I wouldn't mind teaching on a college level, at a college level, as a screenwriter part-time, because I'm 63 years old, so I'm not looking to, you know, be going headstrong and work, you know, a lot. But I enjoy it, and I don't want to kill myself over teaching. But can one teach with an MFA? And
one can, but the competition for screenwriting, there's so many, especially here in the Bay Area, blessed with lots of artist types. Somebody who is an unproduced screenwriter. It's not like you've had two or three major motion pictures, or even minor motion pictures. You will have been a graduate, even if you could get into a program, which is, believe me, at any age, and even with a lot of experience, it is not easy to get into UCLA's or Cal State Northridge's screenwriting program. If you wanted to teach screenwriting, or you wanted to do screenwriting, I'm going to tell you my story of screenwriting. It's worth telling. When I booked that guest, Lou Hunter, on the show, he said to me in the pre-interview, he said, you know, I do my homework before I accept an invitation. I notice you do a lot of writing. Why don't you write some screenplays? Well, that's kind of music to my ears. So I decided to write screenplays. And he said he'd agree to read them, which is an amazing thing. I felt very honored, and I love to write, so it didn't take too much arm twisting. So I wrote a screenplay, and he gave me feedback. He's a wonderful man. And he said, keep writing, keep, he wrote his term was write on, W-R-I-T-E on, at the end of each one of his feedback letters. I wrote a second one. He gave me more feedback, getting great, getting right on. I wrote a third. I wrote a fourth. After the fourth, he said, this is great. I'm going to write you a letter. You go get yourself an agent who specializes in screenwriting. I was probably about 50 at the time or something like that. I don't remember. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. I sent that letter along with my query to 28 carefully selected agents who specialize in screenwriters in Hollywood. I couldn't even get an agent, even though I've had, at that point, I had 8 books published and 2,000 articles, and I got the letter from this god of screenwriting. I then learned subsequently that at William Morris, the premier agency, that they get scripts, so many scripts, they send a truck to the loading dock and have them shredded unread. So my point to you is, my friend, I want you to write screenplays. I don't regret having done that. It was a wonderful experience. But write a few screenplays, read a few books, read Lou Hunter's book called Screenwriting 434, read a few books on screenwriting, maybe take one course, and then, you know, and then maybe go to a local adult school and say, I'm going to teach a course on screenwriting. You will have the benefit of all of that without the huge cost of an MFA. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I do. That the bachelor's degree I have is in film writing with, not film writing, but it was in film, but my concentration was in screenwriting, and I have, I was a semi-finalist in the screenwriting competition, and I really enjoy screenwriting, so I would go into it just for two purposes. One is to beef up my screenwriting skills and submit scripts while I'm there at the college and afterwards, and as well teach.
You can do it, but I'm advising against it. Too expensive, too much time. Take a course from somebody who you think is a great screenwriter. There are great screenwriting courses here in the Bay Area. Take one. Write some more scripts. Submit them. I don't want to mind you submitting them to contests. It's a $50 admission, you know, enrollment entry fee. Do that. That's no problem at all. But I'm nervous about you spending $100,000 on an MFA when even if you could get in, and believe me, it is not easy to get in at any age, and while they claim to not be ageist, a 63-year-old who has no production experience with his screenwriting because he was just a semi-finalist in some contest, some, you know, script-a-palooza contest, is probably not going to be, you know, viable. And so, you know, I like to be positive where I can, but I'd be guilty of malpractice if I think I encourage you in the situation.
You're being realistic, and I'm listening. So,
that's who I am. Anyway, yes. I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Bye.
Okay. You know, last week, a listener emailed me, and he emailed me wishing that I had mentioned that my guest last week, who was the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Alex Kaczynski, he wished that I had mentioned that he chose to retire amid allegations of a sexual nature. And I chose not to mention that in the interview because my program is about career issues, as you know. It's not a news show. And the topic was, what's it really like to be a judge? And I was concerned that because of the nature of the unproven in court of law allegations, that some listeners at least might be distracted from the on-topic points he would make. And those points were well worth listening to. Not only did he spend three decades on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, not only was he its chief judge, but he had clerked for liberal U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Douglas and conservative Chief Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger. So I indeed invite you to listen to the interview, which is on this week's KALW.org webpage for this program. And for completeness there, I've also posted three links to the allegations and three links to his writings. Again, always trying to serve you. We're almost out of time. I have another minute, so I think I don't have, you know, I'll try to take one call quickly. Let's go back to the phone. Let's take one quick call. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. Ask your question quickly. Hello, it's you. Hi.
Oh, it's me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yay. Okay. Hi. Okay, I have this question, right? My background is in international relations, and then I moved here to the U.S., and I did a master's in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
But I find myself to be a very entrepreneurial person. It's just that the opportunity to get into the field I'd like to get has been very difficult. I tend to plan things out very well just so that I know what the next step I'm going to have to take, I need to take is.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, wanting to start a business right now, especially within this economic time, is not, I don't know.
What's your specialty? You said you have a very narrow, very specific specialty. What is your specialty?
Specialty, like I said, I went to school for business administration.
That's very general.
Yes. The specialty was actually international business.
It's still very broad. What specialty would mean being an expert at Vietnamese agriculture, joint partnerships with the United States, or energy in Gazprom in Russia. You need, in order to either be a consultant, even if you're joining a firm, let alone starting a firm, you need to have claim to a real narrow expertise. Nobody's going to hire a generalist to be a consultant. And if you don't yet have that narrow expertise, you need to take the next 3 months, 6 months, whatever, to take some aspect of that intersection between the MBA and the IR degree and find a niche, perhaps using, you know, you say you're an immigrant, using your cultural and linguistic competence as part of that niche development. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I actually found myself, like, looking to go, like, it came up as an idea of maybe going to law school for business.
I'm nervous. You have two degrees already. There's a lot of people who end up going more school, more school, more school.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, you have made some progress toward your specialization, and then you feel like, oh, my God, if only I had a law degree, that's the time to go, especially if an employer will pay. But right now, I would urge you to find that niche of specialization in within your existing skill set, perhaps augmented by a course or two, and that's about it. And now the show is over, so I need to thank you for the call, but I do thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay.
And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover, plus ghosting at work. You know, you leave a voicemail and then, silence, you're ghosted. Or you've applied for a job, silence, ghosting. It's become epidemic. Why and what to do? We'll talk about that next week. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.